Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten. And on today's episodes, we talk the World Cup semi-finals.
There's only so many games that you can win when you're giving up 13, 14, 15 shots a game.
That's so many shots.
Really struggling to create top quality chances.
Look ahead to this Sunday's final. Messi's played with some pretty incredible talent with Argentina, but this is actually the best Argentina team he's played in. And of course, we bring you the Burn Book.
Anything I want to do within the next 3 weeks, I can justify by saying, fuck it, it's Christmas. It's just pure hedonism. Love it.
While over on the subscription side, we discuss Joao Felix to Arsenal.
If this happens, it's going to be a very big chunk of whatever budget Edu and Arteta have to work with. And that is my concern with that. I think it could be better used elsewhere.
Whether Southgate should stay or go as England manager. Yeah, so if he is going to play that way for England, I might want maybe a little bit more of a tactically sophisticated manager to teach him that role. And we look at the forthcoming war against the machines. That's all on this week's episode of Unseen Incidents. Hello, hello. It's the Unseen Incidents pod and Peter Dorman is here as usual. How are you doing, Pete?
I am very, very well. Doing better than you today, I believe. How are you doing? More to the point, Patrick.
Oh, I feel awful. Feel awful. This is the best I felt all week. And like, as I'm sitting here, I'm simultaneously so cold that I can't take off this gilet that I'm wearing over an overshirt. But I also kind of feel myself like sweating. It's genuinely miserable.
There's two lovely shades of khaki green going on between the gilet and the overshirt.
Yes.
It's quite delightful, quite fisherman-esque, if I do say so.
I'd say it's quite hobbit-esque. All my outfits have become really hobbity because my my big winter coat is green and the gilet that I own and wear under it is gold. So I look exactly like Sam from Lord of the Rings.
I did notice your green overcoat on the Instagram and really appreciate the fit. Also love how it looks kind of bathrobe-y as well.
Yeah, very yeah, slight, like boucle.
Yeah, just like a hint of bathrobe being like, it's chic, but also cozy.
Thank you. In my mind, you're definitely a sharp, like camel overcoat kind of guy.
I have a camel one, yes. I have a black one too. I mean, default to black is
yeah,
my...
you do wear a lot of black.
If I don't know what I mean, always default to black. You can't go wrong with black on black.
Yeah.
Or true. Monochrome. Actually, I really struggle with navy because
I've lost my interest in navy.
I hate navy and black together. They don't go.
No.
And all of my stuff contains at least something black, which makes navy, I need an entirely different section of my wardrobe just to accommodate navy clothing.
That's, well, I don't know though. Don't you have quite a lot of cream and tan and stuff? Like those would all go in navy, right?
Top layers, yes, but bottom layers, no.
Okay, fair enough. See, my issue with navy, I think, is that when you're a kid, if you're a boy, you end up wearing quite a lot of blue. And I'm actually not really a fan of blue. I never really liked blue. I don't have blue eyes. Like, I don't think I look particularly nice in blue.
I think blue's fine. It's navy. Because you can wear a royal blue with black.
Ooh.
It's the navy and black. They're too similar, but not the same. And that clashes, for me, at least.
I don't know, though. All the other shades of blue, I also think, are a bit much. But I'm kind of phasing navy out of my wardrobe. I've just come to the realization that I just want to wear, like, earth tones, really, you know?
Autumnal colours all year round.
We dress the baby in earth tones as well. We decided that her colour palette was going to be earth tones. So, you know, I say we decided her colour palette. It's like you buy a multi-pack of, like, bodysuits and we're like, we will get the ones that are, like...
burnt orange.
Ecru and orange and brown, rather than the ones that are, like, black and mint and blue. These are very important decisions, I've got to say. What are you drinking today, by the way? Because I can see you drinking out of like one of those little chalice-y beer mugs.
So I'm starting off with a Erdinger Weiss beer.
Oh, nice.
A German wheat beer. Yeah. And out of shot, you can't see it at the minute, but I've got a bottle of Montepulciano resting on the radiator, warming
up. Just warming.
Up. Just warming. I'm gonna open it and let it breathe in a few minutes. While I finish my beers, and then I'll move on to that. Oh, what are you on? Are you on just on the Lemsips or gin and Lemsip maybe?
You know, I did. You suggested hot port earlier today, and I did actually go looking for it, but we don't actually have any port in the house at the moment. It gets finished quite quickly. So what I'm drinking today is lukewarm water.
Oh, no, not even any lemon in it, just straight up water, slightly warm.
Just like going Chinese medicine, like on this this disease that's rampaging through my body at the moment. Basically, my teeth have been chattering and I've been shivering so much that the prospect of drinking cold water was actually like making me scared. So now I'm having to drink like warmish water, just to try and like maintain a normal human body temperature.
Also, warmish water has to be one of the worst drinks ever.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
It's like pond water. It's like how you imagine that water that comes out of the bottom of a bin would be. It's absolutely rank, but I have at least been drinking it, and for the first time in 3 days, I don't have a headache. So,
you know, take the wins where you can, right?
Exactly. Chinese medicine know what they're doing. That's why they've got such a big population. They know what the fuck they're doing. Anyway, moving on from that, should we talk about the World Cup semi-finals? Because the matchups were not that appetizing, I've got to say, prior to the games. It was kind of that thing where I was like, you know what, if it weren't for the fact the World Cup comes once every 4 years and that also we do a podcast about football and also I have another job to do with football, I don't even know if I bother watching these games. Like, they're not that interesting. But they turned out to be a lot better than I thought, especially the second one. But should we start with Argentina-Croatia?
I get what you say about them not seeming overly appetizing on the face of it, but also at the same time I kind of think the occasion is what's generally appetizing to most football games, unless you're actively a supporter of one of those teams or nations.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
And I think the results across the board, was they ended up in a final that I think we would have both agreed with. So, you know, the both games went largely the way I thought they would have.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, fair play to Croatia. They've gone to a World Cup final, followed it up with a World Cup semi-final, and essentially just have a very, very good midfield and not a huge lot else. And I think that became so evident. It wasn't as evident in 2018 as it was this World Cup, because they have been... Modric has been brilliant, but in terms of their ability to actually score, dire.
Yeah.
Or create chances. Modric can only do so much.
Yeah.
Their ability to create chances has been pretty poor. And just looking at the XG on some of their games, they're getting battered.
Yeah.
And I think Argentina 3-0 was probably maybe a little bit harsh on them, but closer to the fair result than them beating Brazil.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, like, that 2018 team kind of had that Perisic to Mandzukic supply line, right?
Mm.
Whereas even though I really like Kramaric, they just never kind of got it going in this one. And, yeah, I don't know. Like, obviously, their plan was kind of, we don't have enough talent to go, like, properly toe-to-toe with Brazil or Argentina, but we do have enough midfield talent that we can basically keep the ball away from them. Like, we can deny them like the opportunity to build momentum and like cut through us. But in this game, like, it was just so when you talk about the XG there, like, against Brazil, Croatia had 0.6 XG and gave up 2.3. against Argentina, they had 0.4 XG and gave up 2 plus a penalty, which is normally about 0.75. So the game plan and the execution were actually quite similar across those two games. It's just that Brazil didn't finish those chances and Argentina did. Like, their aim was still like, right, we're going to make sure that there aren't a lot of shots in this game. And in the first half of this Argentina match, even though they were 2-0 down at half time, they'd only given up 5 shots. You know, it had been quite a low event game. And basically their whole strategy is, let's make sure that the game is quite grindy, quite dull, and hope that teams don't score their chances, which is not an unreasonable plan. It's a plan suited to their talent. But Argentina just did score those chances. They were big chances.
They were huge chances.
Well, yeah, because it was 5 shots in the first half, but it was like 1.5 XG in the first half, which is that's like 3 times the average shot quality of a shot in the Premier League.
But also, even if you just take in their XG, which was what, 2, you said?
Yeah, yeah, plus a pair.
They had 10 shots in the game. So that's 0.2 per shot XG, that's, essentially.
If you
just divide every shot they took minus the penalty, their expected goals per shot is 0.2, which is over double, or just about double the average quality of chucks, which is crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, and then you factor in the fact that, like, some of those shots are being taken by Messi.
Yeah.
you are seriously in trouble. Whereas Brazil, you know, Brazil have phenomenal talent, but I don't think anyone would necessarily argue that, say, Vinicius is the most lethal finisher in the world or whatever. I mean, I don't want to get into that too much, but basically, like, it felt like after the Brazil game, Croatia had gone through, so there was a lot of narrative in the press that was just like, Croatia are amazing, they had a great game plan. You know, like, whenever a team wins a game, there's always this response from the football press where they want to kind of suggest that all of history led to this happening. Like, they were like, it was inevitable they'd win this game because of the way their academies produce talent. You know, like, that sort, you get those sorts of stories coming out, and then they lose to Argentina and suddenly it's like, what went wrong? And you're like, no, they did exactly the same performance. It's just that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. That's fine.
They've also done this the entire tournament as well.
Yeah.
So if you look at their XG across the entire tournament, across their 6 games, the only game where they have an XG above 1 was Canada.
They did have quite a lot in that game, though.
Yeah. but also Canada did crumble in the second half.
Yeah. Yeah, and also Croatia had to come out at them because they were goal down, and Canada were a little bit naive.
I think in the Japan game, their XG was around 1. Some have them slightly lower, some have them slightly higher, but also that went 3 extra time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there was, other than that Canada game, there was no real attacking prowess in that team. There was no huge goal-scoring threat or creative hub.
Mm-hmm.
For chances, and it was very much, let's control the game, let's control the ball, let's not concede, or let's hope they don't score. Mm-hmm. And it'll take 1 goal to win it, or it'll take penalties to win it. And also, you know, they relied hugely on Livakovic as well, particularly in it was a Brazil game. He made 11 saves in that Brazil game. I think it was 11 saves. And also, before the Argentina game, Croatia conceded just 3 goals, despite their expected goals against being like a slightly over 8.
Jesus.
In 5 games. So essentially he's saving a goal a game, like a full expected goal per game.
God, that is true, yeah.
Yeah.
And, God, that's nuts.
A team like Croatia, who are only ever really going to win, bar Canada, are only ever going to really win by 1 goal.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least how they've set up this tournament. That is literally the difference between them finishing top of their group and going to the semi-finals and not getting out of their group.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, the thing is, sometimes when you say stuff like this in football, people get offended, right? Because they think that you're criticizing a team if you say that actually they're quite defensive, or they're quite grindy, or they've been overperforming XG. But that's not really it. It's like, they had a great goalkeeping performance and some great midfield performances, and they put away their one kind of half chance against Brazil, and those things have been enough to carry them to a World Cup semi-final. I mean, like, that's great. Having some hot streaks at the World Cup is kind of what the World Cup's all about. Looking at Croatia going through against Brazil, you were like, this isn't sustainable. Whereas, we'll touch on them in a bit, but Morocco going through against Portugal, you looked at them, you looked at the XG of that game, you watched that game, and I was like, Morocco is just straight up the better team here.
Yeah.
Like, this is not Morocco, you know, suffering through a million chances and hitting on the break. This is actually Morocco outplaying Portugal.
And there's always an element of luck to a lot of small team or smaller teams making deep runs in these tournaments. But like you say, Morocco was more of a well-executed game plan that put themselves in the best position to win while also exploiting the weaknesses of their opposition. Croatia kind of just seemed to be doing what they could to hang on and just hoping it all worked out in the end.
Yeah.
In the knockout stages, Japan, Brazil, Argentina, they gave up 43 shots in three games.
I mean, they did go to extra time twice, I guess.
But still, 43 shots in three games is, for a team that is struggling to get over one XG per game, eventually that's going to catch up on you. There's only so many games that you can win when you're giving up 13, so 14, shots. 15 shots a game.
Yeah, and that's real.
Really struggling to create top quality chances.
Yeah, that's the big. That's almost the bigger thing for me, because like
the two are linked, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I mean, like, say your game plan is we're just going to run up and down with you. Like Brazil have kind of been like that at points this tournament, and France are like that at points. It's like we're going to go up and down with you, and we're just going to trust that we're more likely to score the big chances we get than you are to score the chances you get. But the problem with Croatia is it's like they can't match teams who are creating big chances. If they go a goal down, they can't change the rhythm of the game and start dominating and start creating those chances themselves. Whereas even Morocco, again, against France, when they were a goal down, they came back into the game. They didn't just sit off. So that really does hurt you when you don't have a plan B. You know, like I understand. Look, you're with national teams, you're stuck with the talent you've got, so you kind of got to do it. But it's a little bit, I don't know. In some ways, they're kind of like Conte's Spurs this season, just without top class attackers. You know, where Conte's Spurs at times seem to have been playing for draws. Then they go a goal down, and then suddenly they're like, "Oh shit, we should attack." Croatia are like that. But when they said, "Oh shit, we should attack," they still couldn't attack.
Yeah, they just stay the same. Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
I don't want to butcher the Morocco section too much, but when they went to go down, they changed their system, and they took the game to France. The point I have here written in my notes about Croatia is that once they went behind, it never felt like they were getting back in that game.
No, not at all.
Before the first goal went in, it felt like Croatia had a better foothold on the game. Argentina didn't look great. Croatia didn't necessarily look dangerous, but they looked comfortable. And then the goal went in, and you're thinking, right, okay, what did Croatia do at this point?
It was an absolutely incredible penalty as well.
Yeah, oh, it was so good.
And then somebody came out and went, "Oh, he's just leathered it." And I was like, "What are you talking?" He put it in the top corner at like 100 miles. And it was, given that Messi across his career,
it was also like right in, you know, where all so the fabric good. Meets. It was right in that point. It wasn't in the stands. It was back in the back corner of the net, right where all of the fabric points meet in that like perfect little corner. And it was hit so hard as well. It was
so good, man. Oh. I absolutely loved it. And then the Alvarez goal is kind of funny too, because he literally just runs in a straight line. He just runs towards the goal. He runs like Dan James, like just in a completely straight line, and scores. It's so weird.
You've got to respect being direct. You know, I think
for
a lot of forwards, if you look at like Bukayo Saka was great for England because he was so direct. He got the ball and just went to players. And if you do that, there are going to be instances where the ball just bobbles around and falls in your favour. Unlikely to happen three times in the same run, but, you know, fair play.
But a runner plus Messi is a plan that works for literally anybody, right?
And I love how Messi, the goal where he absolutely stood up,
Guardiol.
Kind of shows how he's adapted his game with age. He didn't try and gas him straight on it. He stood him up and then was like, "I'm going to beat you over these 3 yards, not beat you over these 20 yards. And Messi is just such a leveler on any game in his current form. Doesn't matter what team you're playing in or against, having Messi, like that goal he set up there, was anybody could have scored that. I could have scored that.
Yeah.
And him being able to do that with a player also as mobile as Alvarez is just class. They're just a really good team,
and because they're so solid as well. Like, I mean, I can't remember who pointed this out on Twitter, but Messi's played with some pretty incredible talent with Argentina. You know, Mascherano and Cambiasso, Roberto Ayala, like endless talent. But this is actually the best Argentina team he's played in.
I totally agree.
They're completely solid. They've got a system that totally works. They've given up the fewest shots in the tournament. Yeah. They're giving up 5.7 shots a game. And then on top of that, it's like, okay, right, we've got a rock solid defense, and then we've got Messi and Alvarez, and we've got Lautaro Martinez, who I think has been a bit kind of unfairly maligned this tournament. He's still a useful player for them to have. And that is just enough. Like, I mean, since Alvarez has come into the team, he's now scored 4 goals. Messi's got 5 goals and 3 assists, which when Maradona won the Golden Ball in 1986, he got 5 goals, 5 assists that tournament. Yeah. So I think there are maybe more games now, but Messi could easily match that if he gets a couple of goal involvements in the fight. He has just been unbelievable. And actually, interestingly, I've seen a lot of people that every time Messi, it's like when Messi used to play an English team in the Champions League. Do you remember that time when Barcelona beat Spurs like 4-2 or something? And suddenly a load of like English press guys like John Cross and stuff started saying, oh, I've always been a Ronaldo person, but this was actually a great performance from Messi. And you were like, this is literally an average performance from Messi. This is what Messi does every single week. It's completely normal.
This is a declining Messi as well. This is a Messi he's not as good as he was 7 years ago.
No. And yet he's still the best player in the world.
But he also scored like 90 goals in a calendar year.
Yeah.
Like, just put that into perspective. There's 52 weeks in a year.
Yeah.
And he scored 90. He was scoring 2 goals a week, essentially. Just
Oh my God. And also, like, when you think about some of, like, the great players in history, like, there, a lot of players didn't actually get that many. I think Brazilian Ronaldo maybe got something like 250 career goals. Like, Messi got a third of that in a year.
Yeah.
Like, Dennis Bergkamp got 264 career goals. That is genuinely 3 years' work for Messi.
Yeah.
It's absolutely bananas. And now he's kind of trying. There were people last year trying to compare Ronaldo's goal numbers to Messi's goal numbers, and they were ignoring the fact Messi got like 13 assists or something. Like, playing alongside Mbappe is just like a cheat code. And I'm kind of glad that what we're going to get is a final between the two best players in the world. You know, at this tournament, I think, well, we'll come on to that, and I don't want to do down people like Griezmann and stuff, but Messi and Mbappe are kind of head and shoulders above everybody else. And it's just interesting to hear people who I've never really heard say it before talking about Messi as like, wow, this is like the greatest of all time that we're seeing right now. And it's like,
it's weird though, because I think it's almost gone too far. In that, I think a lot of the... Right, so Messi's a phenomenal player, probably the best player that's ever played the game. What I'm hearing from commentators at the minute are just an immense amount of superlatives at the most average thing he does, which is kind of pissing me off.
Of course it is.
Say he does this little, like, ball-retaining turnout and passes the ball back. The commentator would be like, genius. Genius from Messi there. And it's like, no, it was just a good move from a professional football player. He'll do something genius in this match. Save it for that. But anything he does now, anytime he touches the ball, everyone's like, he's just a genius. And it's like, he is a genius, but that specific moment you're trying to describe was not genius. It was just a pretty average move from a genius player.
Yeah, I get it.
It's almost like they're trying to make up the lost years that they were like, Messi and Ronaldo are pretty close.
It's like if you were like delivering post to like Ralph Lauren's house, and he like answered the door like wearing like his wife's slippers or something, and you looked at him and you were like, wow, what an amazing fashion choice. You know, it's kind of that thing now with Messi where commentators, just like anything he does, they're like, well, he's amazing, so that must be amazing.
Yeah.
But it's like, the stuff that's actually amazing this tournament is just the fact that when you give the ball to him, shots come out the other end. Now at this stage of his career, truly, he's never really cared, I think, whether he scores or creates.
No.
And certainly he doesn't now. And there is a real harmony in this Argentina team, which is quite inspiring to see. And I think they've evolved over the course of the tournament. They've admittedly ended up having a pretty nice run to the final. But at the same time, you can only beat what's in front of you, and they've just dominated games. They've dominated. Yeah. I mean, since that blip against Saudi Arabia, even then I thought they were fine. They've just gone from strength to strength.
So since the Saudi Arabia game, their aggregate score is 11-3 in five games. Like, that's just comfortable. And you touched on it earlier. I think this team is so good because I've always felt that Argentina are quite a top-heavy nation. They've always been quite a top-heavy nation.
Yeah,
this team is really, like, really solid at the back.
Yeah,
like you said, best defense in the tournament. Otamendi's been fantastic.
Yeah.
He's played every minute. The only other two players for Argentina to play every minute are Emi Martinez and Messi.
Right.
So it kind of just shows that his influence in that back four, the trust the kind of manager has in him. And when you have a solid defense, if you have Messi in your team, that's literally a perfect scenario. If you, as a defender or as a defensive unit, can limit the opposition to one goal, and you have Lionel Messi in your team, you back yourself to win every game.
Yeah, it would be crazy not to get on the score sheet with Messi on your side.
And you know you're going to score one, probably more. If you can limit them to a maximum of one goal, you're best placed to win that game.
And yeah, that defense, I think it's absolutely right. Like, you feel, especially, you feel it with Otamendi, but you especially feel it, I think, with Emi Martinez and Lisandro Martinez. That, like, I think Emi Martinez, there was some quote from him from half time of the Croatia game where he was like, they will have to kill me to score a goal in this game. Something like that. And you're like, yeah, kind of that is what you need. You need a little bit of that in the World Cup. And they've got some players who just have that dog in them. And and I think
they're a great shithouse team. They are such a good shithouse team.
They're such a good shithouse team. And I think Alvarez helps there as well. The number of times that Alvarez just takes a tactical foul and it just gets impossible. You know, against Croatia, when they were 2-0 up, you thought, okay, they're pretty comfortable now. You'd imagine they'd be happy to let Croatia have the ball in midfield. And they were just kind of hacking them, tripping them, like stopping them settling into possession. And so it meant that while Croatia had 60% of the ball in the game, there was just no significant danger at any point. I mean, they had something like 12 shots and half of those were outside the box. Nothing was a big chance. There was just never any danger. So, I don't know. They feel pretty complete to me, Argentina, given that man for man, they are not like staggering. They're not Brazil level. I don't think they're even England level man for man.
Yeah.
But they are just a coherent unit that works super well. And they're going to the World Cup final, and Messi's going to have a chance to win the World Cup in his last ever international game. So,
but also, I would say they're going to the World Cup final as the most informed team as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
England have all this talent. Brazil have this immense amount of talent, but particularly with Brazil, I felt like they never got out of third gear. They never managed to get up to top gear of what they could be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas. And England were good. England were good in this tournament. I think they played well, and I think they were unlucky. And that just happens against a good team. They came up against a good team and lost.
Yeah.
But Argentina have looked relatively comfortable so far.
Yeah.
And I still think they have a little bit more to give as well. I think they've got another gear to go.
We'll come on to that, I think, when we talk about the final bit. But I agree with you. I mean, I think with Brazil especially, there's that thing of, it's always said as a compliment, isn't it? Like, they haven't even got out of first gear yet, you know, whatever. And then you think, okay, well, you're implying there's more to come. But at a certain point, they've got to find that gear.
Well, yeah, it's only a compliment if it comes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it just never did. Like, so... Yeah, I mean, they created a bunch of chances against Croatia, but you would have liked to have seen them push on and just completely destroy them in that game. And, okay, they put up 2xG, but that's not, like, the most insane attacking performance you've ever seen in your life. Like, they could have really put a hurt on them if they wanted to.
Yeah.
They didn't, really. So, anyway, shall we move on to France-Morocco? So this one was an interesting one, France-Morocco. France obviously ran out 2-0 victors, thanks to goals from Theo Hernandez and Randall Colomouani. To be honest, I think we all thought Morocco's plan here is not to concede.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
they conceded in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
First time they've been behind all tournament, and we were kind of like, oh, shit.
Also, right. The fact that that was the first time they were behind in the World Cup, and it was a semi-final, and they're Morocco. That statistic alone
is nuts.
Is nuts. The first time in the competition they were behind was a semi-final.
I know. I know. It's I mean, like, the scale of the achievement from Morocco is kind of hard to wrap your head around. And it'll be really interesting to see where they are in a few years' time, because obviously some of their key players are going to age out. You know, Ziyech will age out and Saïss will age out. Other guys like Hakimi and En-Nesyri and Unahi, you'd expect to really progress. But it's interesting to know whether this kind of sets the tone for them going forward. But what was really impressive in this game was that once they went a goal down, you were like, right, they're going to have to try and change a game against the world champions. And they did it.
Yeah.
You know, like, that Hakimi matched up against Mbappe, you thought, oh, this is going to be rough for them because Hakimi's such an outlet. He's going to have to sit back and defend Mbappe. And he just said, no. Yeah. His average position was over the halfway line. He had more touches in the France penalty area than any other Moroccan player. And as soon as they conceded, they just started playing through the midfield, I thought, fairly easily. And I thought, I don't know if this is because Rabiot's dropped out. I don't know if this is just because Morocco's midfielders might be really good. Like Amrabat and Unahi might just be really good. But it felt like they could get, while they weren't getting shots off exactly, they were able to get to the box pretty much without breaking a sweat. Yeah.
I missed the first goal because I was feeding. I was feeding my cat. Right, I was feeding Taco his dinner because he eats at 7 p.m. and the game kicked off at 7. I came back up to the office and it was 1-0. Now I was like, okay, here we go. This is what this game's going to be.
Yeah,
Morocco have had a great run. They've gone to go down against the world champions and they're going to crumble here.
Yeah.
And then I watched the next 10 minutes and I was like, okay, right. Game settled down a bit. Then they were forced into two substitutions pretty early on.
Yeah, right? Saïss had to go off.
And so they started with a back five, which I think was their problem. They sat so deep that they invited all that pressure in, and that's why they conceded that first goal. And it's a bit unfortunate because they did have huge injury problems in defence. And the fact that I'm thinking that, saying that it's unfortunate that Morocco didn't have their full strength team against France in this World Cup semi-final is a bit crazy. But in it, part of me thinks that they were a little bit hard done by in that, based on how the rest of the game played out.
Yeah.
Because they then brought a midfielder on and went to 4 at the back, went to 4-5-1, which they'd done in all the tournament up to that point. And they were so good comparative to how they were in that first like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I say they feel a bit hard done by because they lost 2-0. The XG was about 2 to 0.7, 0.8.
Yeah.
I don't feel that's a fair reflection on that game.
Neither do I.
Because I think, like you said, Morocco got into the box fairly easily.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like they got into really, really dangerous positions, but were never quite able to pull the trigger to get a shot off. They always tried to find an extra half yard to get a shot and ended up kind of getting pushed out wide and then recycling the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no, while being in a hugely dangerous area, the fact they haven't taken a shot means that it doesn't really affect those statistics. There's no shot that's recorded. The XG isn't affected. And you're thinking, like, it doesn't really take much to change that scenario entirely. If they had an extra half yard space, that's a goal. Or a really high, really, really high XG chance. And those numbers could be completely flipped in that if they were able just to find a fraction more somewhere to get a couple of shots off when they got into those positions, which they were getting into quite easily. I think Hakimi had the most touches in the opposition box of any Moroccan player.
Yeah, yeah.
Which shows just how attacking they're being, right? Particularly Hakimi. I think they were really close to winning that game. I think if you play that game exactly as it played out, you know, 100 times, I think they win quite a few of them.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's, sometimes you don't create XG or like big scoring opportunities because you just simply aren't capable of creating them. And sometimes it doesn't happen because defenders just make key interventions at the right minute and you don't get a shot off. And in this game, I just thought the French back line was great, especially the centre backs. I mean, Konaté made 7 tackles and interceptions. Varane only made 1, but was constantly... I mean, there's stuff like there was a cross kind of whipped across the box in the second half that I think En-Nesyri very, very, very nearly got a foot on. And Varane got a knee to it first. There were things like that constantly where you were just like, okay, yeah. Like, as you say, that's an inch or two away from being not only a shot, but being a huge scoring chance. And that's fine. You know, the great advantage of having great defenders is that they can make great plays. But it also shows that Morocco were able to put them under that much pressure that those defenders had to do that amount. And that Tchouaméni and Fofana weren't really protecting the back line that much. I mean, the back line between them made 17 tackles and interceptions, which is kind of a lot. And Morocco passed into the final third as much as France did, passed into the box more than France did. And I think if that second goal hadn't come, the end of this game would have been extremely tense, extremely tense. I don't know. It was fascinating because up until this point as well, Morocco had not had over 50% possession in a single game at the World Cup. And in this game, they had 61% possession.
I think if you take the fact that the Morocco out of that statistic and say that a team had 61% possession in a World Cup semi-final against the defending champions, it doesn't matter what team that is. That is impressive. The fact that it's Morocco is it. I keep coming back to this point that it's genuinely unbelievable, but it is. And I really think that I'm not going to say France were lucky. I'm going to say more that Morocco were unlucky to not have been closer and to not have been in the game right at the end, because if you think about the two French goals, they've both come out of deflected shots.
Yeah.
They weren't a created move. It wasn't, I'm going to skin this guy, pass to this guy at back post, and he's going to tap it in. It's, I'm going to take this shot. Oh, it's been deflected. And it's just fallen to Hernandez. And he's, to be fair, it's not a tap. His wasn't a tap, and it was still a good finish. But it wasn't a move that was manufactured. It was a move that kind of fell out of just a second phase of an attack, which there's always an element of luck to. Now, he obviously had to finish that. Oh, the second one was a lot easier, back post. But those the fact that those were the two defining moments on the score sheet make me feel that Morocco were a bit hard done by.
Yeah.
Based on the fact that they also got into those situations and maybe didn't pull the trigger when they should have. You know, maybe that's just a bit of experience at you know, tournament top level football, is that when you get into the box, just take a shot and see what happens. Yeah. You know, if you're there, just take a shot. You don't know, it deflects, goes in. It might just be deflected and go out. Just anything might happen. Whereas Morocco kind of seemed just to try and find that extra little bit of room or that just add to the quality of the chance they already had, as opposed to just taking a shot when they're in a decent position and seeing what happens. And I think that was kind of what, that was where France's both, the French goals came from. But like,
yeah, both times it was Mbappe taking a shot, right?
Yeah. It was Mbappe taking a shot. There was a deflection and it fell to
the bat stick for somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah. And for what most people, almost every person I would say, it's not Moroccan, would have had down as a pretty comfortable French game, French win, I think it was anything but. I think that game could have gone either way.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, look, I in the end, I'm not too sad about it because I agree that Morocco were a bit hard done by, but I think they still got their Cinderella run.
Yeah.
They still, you know, have achieved things that certainly no African team has ever achieved before. And we still kind of get pretty much the highest quality final we could have hoped for. But you know, you look at these, by the time this podcast will go out on the morning of Saturday, and in the afternoon, the third, fourth place playoff will be played. I would not be surprised if Morocco just like play better than Croatia. I'm not saying they'll necessarily win, but I would not be surprised if they just play better than Croatia. because I just think this was truly really enlightening. If this hadn't happened, if they played the whole game defensively and then France had scored in like the 91st minute and it had just ended up like 1-0 like that, we wouldn't have learnt what we did about Morocco. So I kind of like that they went a goal down earlier, because actually, while they already, you know, deserved a lot of respect in my eyes, my estimation of them went way up on the basis of this performance.
I fully expected them to crumble at that point.
Yeah.
As soon as that goal went in, I was like, this is what this game is. And I couldn't have been more wrong. And yeah, I agree that it's essentially the best of both worlds, that result, because you have that beautiful romantic moment of Morocco's famous cup run, first African nation to reach semi-final, you know, fantastic, but also Argentina-Morocco final that ends up 3-0 and Messi scored a hat-trick. You're like, right, well, great, cool, see you in 4 years. There's nothing really special about that.
Yeah.
It's
This final that we've got, I mean, we might as well move on to the final. Yeah, it's like the two best players in the world up against each other. It's like the reigning South American champions versus the reigning world champions. And, you know, both these teams deserve to be here. Like France, I think France have been helped in lots of ways. You know, I think that the injuries force them into a lineup that I prefer and into a style I prefer. You know, in the past, that Griezmann role would have been played by Matuidi and they were much more grindy. But now it's an attacker playing there rather than a midfielder, so that's a bit more fun. And Teo Hernandez playing instead of Luka Hernandez, we already talked about that. That's a lot more fun.
More reckless, though.
Oh, sure, but it's kind of worth it. I mean, maybe he should have given up a pen against Morocco. Yeah, because he's been one of the chief chance creators at the World Cup.
Yeah, but he gave away a pen against England for the shoulder barge on Mason Mount, which was nuts. Crazy. Like,
yeah. I don't know why he did it.
Well, he obviously thought he was done, and he didn't know where the ball was, and he was like, fuck, I'm just going to take him out. The only thing I can think of why he did that was because he was certain that Mason Mount was getting on the end of that ball, which means that he didn't know where the ball was.
Yeah. And I think sometimes you probably do push a player and you're not quite sure how hard you're going to push them before you do it.
I mean, there's a push and then there's what looked...
I know.
...tantamount to a rugby tackle.
But he's running... I know.
So he gave a penalty away there, and then he very easily could have given a penalty away against Buffal, which
I would argue it
was a penalty. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow Buffal got a yellow card.
Yeah. No, Buffal did nothing, and it's literally because Buffal got up and Teo was like rolling around on the floor. But I don't know. I guess
that's a concern. That's two penalties in consecutive games in the knockout stages of a World Cup.
But I also think
on top of the two penalties they already give away.
Okay, but we're not talking here from the perspective of people who want France to win the World Cup. We're talking here from the perspective of people who want France to play an actually fun style of football. Because France are not fucking Croatia. Like, they don't have to run out this limited game plan because they've got limited talent that's distributed weirdly through their team. France could play in basically any style that they want. And up until this tournament, they've chosen to play incredibly boring football, like real kind of Capello football, and that's understandable. Yeah, and that's understandable because that's kind of the guy Deschamps is. But I wanted them to be more attacking, and Teo Hernandez does make them a lot less predictable, which I like, but up till now it's been kind of selling out to get Mbappe chances, which actually makes it interesting to me that while Mbappe is level on goals with Messi, and I think he's got two assists as well, Messi's got 5 goals, 3. Mbappe's got 5 goals, 2. Mbappe hasn't scored. He didn't score against England. He didn't score in this game. He's only taken 4 shots across those 2 games. He wasn't anonymous against Morocco, but I actually thought he was fairly anonymous against England. As much as people are talking shit about England's plan to contain Mbappe, I think they did contain Mbappe.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Like, look, France do have more talent than Argentina. But I look at these games. Their last 2 games have been their worst at the tournament. They're 3.2-3 on XG over the last 2 games. So they are coming out ahead. Mm. But those are against England and Morocco. they gave up two penalties against England. They shouldn't really be doing that. Argentina are at 4.5 XG for and 0.9 against in the last two games. And yes, their games have been easier. The Netherlands and Croatia, I think, are weaker sides than England and Morocco. But Argentina are playing as you'd want a team to be playing going into a World Cup final. France aren't really. I don't think France are that impressive right now. They're conceding 10 shots a game. Argentina are conceding 5.7. I just don't... I think about, you know, we were talking about Konate and Varane having really great games against Morocco. No disrespect to Morocco, but having a great game against En-Nesyri or Ziyech is not the same as having a great game against Messi or Lautaro Martinez or Alvarez or Paulo Dybala. It's just not. And so if the game plan once again is, well, Konate and Varane will just handle people one-on-one, that's when I think we start to get in trouble.
Yeah, for me, I have genuine concerns about their defense. This final, at least. I think they've been fine so far, but I don't think they've been great. They haven't kept a clean sheet in any game.
What? Is that true?
They haven't kept a clean sheet in the World Cup. They give away two penalties against England. Arguably should have been three, depending on how you call that first one, where the contact happens on the line and continues into the box.
Yeah.
Easily could have been three penalties.
I always thought that was a penalty if the contact continues into the box, but I don't know. I don't care enough, and England fans were whining enough, so I just left it.
Like, the fact that it wasn't a penalty is actually irrelevant. The fact that the challenge was made and it could have been a penalty is the problem.
Yeah.
The fact that it was rash. And then they could have very easily and probably should have given away a penalty against Morocco. This isn't 180 minutes of football.
Yeah, though on the other hand, they've given up two open play goals in the World Cup.
Yes, but it doesn't matter if you're giving away fucking two penalties a game, right?
Yeah, true. I mean, if they give up a penalty against Argentina and then Argentina can play on the break, that's not going to be a fun time for them.
The way I'm looking at this final is that it is Mbappe against a very good, solid defence that has been solid all tournament. Mm-hmm. And Messi and co. against a questionable defence that hasn't kept a clean sheet and has proven multiple times already to be quite rash at decisive moments and to make bad decisions.
Yeah.
And I think with a player as skillful as Messi, you know.
Yeah, but I also think
I see France it as more problematic.
France's attack, though, has been able to create against everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the one thing. If they did go down and they needed a goal, you wouldn't bet against France getting back into the game. They've got so many weapons. I mean, the England game, yes, Mbappe was quiet, and they still beat a really good, really defensively solid England side.
Yeah, but Mbappe was quiet, but Griezmann was phenomenal.
Yeah, exactly.
In that entire game.
So if Mbappe is quiet, they've still got this...
Yeah.
supply line of Griezmann and Dembele to Giroud, which is really dangerous for them. They've still got Teo Hernandez overlapping, you know, like there's a lot of attacking weaponry there. I don't think their bench is all that strong, but I don't think it's worse than Argentina, certainly. And if Benzema's back and they can bring him off the bench.
Yeah. It's reported that he is fit and available for selection.
Jesus.
So based on reports today, yes. And I think that's a really interesting added dynamic to this game.
Okay.
If they need a goal and they just threw him on with 20 minutes to go, it completely changes how they play. And that could be what they need at that moment. It completely changes their system, their whole mentality. And in a World Cup final with 20 minutes to go, that could be the difference. Just a change. Just something.
But it also could ruin them. You know, like you look at them and you think.
But also at the same time, if they got nothing to lose at that point, then.
Yeah,
who cares?
Sure. Yeah, I guess. I mean, there's something about it that I don't really like. I don't really like the idea of Benzema like helicoptering back in for the final. I don't know why that annoys me so much, but I just think like...
What do you feel is kind of like the John Terry full kit cup lift moment?
A bit, It's just like they've done it without you. You don't get to like turn up for the curtain call. Like if he turns up in the final and like scores the winning goal, maybe. But
yeah,
it makes me want them to lose. just because I think it's, yeah, I don't really think it's kosher. And also, I don't know, I'm not like rooting for anyone in particular, but I think given the choice, I do think Argentina probably deserve it a little bit more. Yeah. And I would like Messi to do it just because
the narrative's nicer, isn't it? Narrative is nicer.
It's more heartwarming. And like, yeah, France won the last one. These players winning a second one. Okay, some of them, they'll be winning a first one, but a lot of them be winning a second one. Mm. It's not that big a deal. To Argentina, Argentina have only ever won the World Cup twice, which is kind of crazy. They haven't won it in 36 years, and it would be the greatest player of all time signing off with a World Cup win. I mean, yeah, and a deserved World Cup win. Like, so, and if he wins that, he'll have won every trophy in the game, like every major trophy that he could have won.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know. I predicted when we, after our group stage, I predicted an Argentina-England final, right? An Argentina to win. And obviously France went through instead. So I think I'm going to stay with that, but it's slightly, it's maybe more of a wish than an expectation that Argentina will win, because France have just been sort of just miserably crushing people's dreams this tournament. They've just been like good enough the whole time. Quite dull, but good enough.
Yeah, I mean, before this, I predicted a Brazil-France final.
Mm-hmm.
But I did caveat that with whoever wins that Brazil-Argentina semi-final, which never happened, but whoever won that hypothetical semi-final would win the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
So Argentina were my second choice to win the tournament.
But that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because if Argentina... We would have a much better sense of how good Argentina were, though, if they'd had to come through a semi against Brazil.
Yeah, I think this is I don't know if it's a flip of a coin, but for me, if I was Argentina, I would be more concerned about handling Griezmann than handling Mbappe.
Sure.
I think if you handle Griezmann, it's easier to handle Mbappe, because Mbappe is more individualistic and kind of does things on his own. So if you handle Griezmann facilitates the rest, right? Everything ticks through Griezmann, and then you have this amazing world-beating player in Mbappe who can just do things out of nothing.
Yeah.
So if you handle Griezmann, you've handled a large part of their attack. Whereas with England handled Mbappe, but then Griezmann just went to work and kind of sat and operated in between those, like, in those negative spaces in between the lines. And it took England, 40 minutes to figure that out? 35 minutes before Bellingham kind of started sitting back a bit and being like, right, this is where all of the problems are coming from. And I think Griezmann's role this tournament has been like a genuine reinvention of him as a player. Because I didn't see him as this type of player. But in this role, he's been phenomenal. His expected assists, he's topping the tournament in expected assists by an absolute mile. Before the semi-final, he was like over 3 and a bit expected assists, and the next closest was like 1.5.
Oh my God.
Like, he, outside of Mbappe's unbelievable talent and output, Griezmann is everything that is good about France, but it's a Griezmann I've never seen. This tournament is a Griezmann I've never really witnessed. Look at him against Morocco. He had no shots, but made 4 key passes.
Yeah.
He had 9 recoveries. Like, it's a completely different role, but he's just absolutely nailing it.
Yeah, I mean, that first goal, he obviously doesn't get an assist, but that goal was created by him more than anybody else.
Yeah.
And I mean, but I understand what you mean. As in, if I were Argentina, I'd think, if Mbappe beats 3 of our defenders and scores,
what can you do?
But we're not going to get beaten by some blockhead shit, like not having a plan to deal with Griezmann.
Yeah.
Like, we come up with a plan to deal with Griezmann, and then our plan for dealing with Mbappe is largely hope our defenders win their duels and hope he doesn't do anything insane. And I think that that's fair enough. Like, you can have the best plan in the world and Mbappe might beat it, but you can come up with a plan to deal with Griezmann, I think. And I think they probably will have like a good idea in mind. I mean,
yeah,
They've got such a smart defense.
I think that's more important.
Agree.
And I think in the England game, you watched them in the first 20 minutes, and like when France were progressing the ball, he was sitting in these kind of like, I'm referring to them as like negative spaces in that.
Mm-hmm.
He was sitting in between the lines, but in a position where he would never get the ball.
Okay.
So he was in space because the team were like, he's never getting the ball there. He's not dangerous. And he wasn't dangerous at that point. But when they progressed the ball and went into the second phase, that was when he moved and got involved in the play. But all he had that space. Nobody was marking him. No matter where he made his run, somebody would still have to track X amount of yards to get to him, by which point he's already got the ball and been able to progress or create. And that was what was killing England until mm-hmm. Henderson or Rice and Bellingham figured out that that is a problem. And Bellingham kind of tucked in a little bit more, gave them a little bit more support in that area and was able to close them down much, much quicker. I assume that will be so similar to how Argentina will deal with him, because that's what he wants to do. He'll kind of float about in those awkward positions. And you essentially need to make a choice of who's more dangerous. Is it Griezmann in that role or Mbappe getting the ball out wide with a little bit of space?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's Griezmann in that role, because Griezmann's ability to create from that role, he's proven this tournament that he can do it easily. Mbappe, if you're set as a defence and he has a little bit of space on the left flank, he's going to have to do something special to get there. If he does do something special, like you say, fair play to him. You can't really mitigate for top quality, world beating, second best player in the world level football. Mm-hmm. That is just him as a player. That is what he's good at. You can't really mitigate for that, but you can disrupt France's entire attack, which I believe goes through Griezmann.
Yeah. So what, do you have a prediction for the final?
If they manage Griezmann, I think 2-1 after extra time.
Yes.
To Argentina. Wow. Argentina. Yeah. What do you think?
I'll go for the same. Yeah. I like that. I love an extra time winner. I think it might be quite an interesting game, which is to say I don't think it'll necessarily be a particularly good game.
Yeah, I think it could be quite cagey.
Yeah, we were quite lucky at the last World Cup to get a really ridiculous final. I don't think that'll be the case this time, because that said though, maybe Messi certainly as an individual might have learnt a bit from the other World Cup final he was in.
Oh, what, the 2014 when they absolute bloodbath? Yeah,
where it was like super cagey and Argentina was so desperate kind of not to lose, and it was just like kind of a miserable game.
De Jong was just two-footing people in the chest.
No, that was the Netherlands Spain.
Is that
not
that game? Oh right, yeah. Sorry, I'm thinking of the wrong game. Yeah.
Who did you think De Jong was playing for in the Germany Argentina? You know,
I'm thinking of the entirely wrong tournament.
But it's I wonder if maybe the older Messi has perhaps a better sense for when his team are in the ascendancy and when they should push on and try and take advantage of their dominance. So I can imagine Messi feeling, if he thinks that France look dodgy, I think Messi might push his team forward. Whereas in that World Cup in 2014, even though, you know, he was still young and had like plenty of time to go to other World Cups, it felt like they were scared of losing. In this game, I think they might be a little bit more, they might be more courageous.
Yeah, I mean, for me, if I was Messi, I would just be like, fuck it. Like, I'm this good. It doesn't matter what stage of the game it's at. It doesn't matter who's on the front foot.
Yeah.
If anybody on that pitch can change those tides, it's him.
Yeah, you'd say
by an absolute mile as well. I know Mbappe can do a lot of brilliant things, but I still think there is, even Messi at his age now, and Mbappe kind of, I suppose, coming towards his peak years. Like, he's coming into that. I still think there's levels to that. And
yeah.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it was KD. Maybe Argentina as a unit were scared to lose. But like, if I'm looking at the two lineups and I've got Lionel Messi in my team, I'm going to find it hard to think that we can't win this game or that I'm scared to lose. I suppose it's different on the night when everything's on it and your legacy as a player rests on 90 minutes.
It's kind of funny though, isn't it, that like people talk about having an anti-Mbappe plan at this World Cup, but no one even bothers talking about having an anti-Messi plan.
There's no point.
Because it's just like there is no such thing. It's been shown at this stage that you cannot have a plan against Messi. So, okay, we're both predicting an Argentina victory. Oh my God. Okay, should we move on to the burn book? Burn book time. And this week I will try not to put something in the burn book that you took out of the burn book the week before, or the other way around even. Pete, where would you like to start? Well, apparently you're starting the wine. Apparently the wine's sufficiently warm.
No, but before we start, I would like to know that I did forget that the wine was on the radiator and now it is quite warm.
It's mulled wine.
It's mulled, yeah.
Yeah, you've mulled it.
It's halfway to being mulled. So we'll let that cool down. Oh, am I starting the Mumbrook this week?
Yeah. Okay. So you start it.
So
either end.
Yeah. Well, I always, if I start, I start. I come in hard.
You come in negative.
I'm coming in with hate. So this week, the thing that I want to put in the burn book, the thing that pissed me off, are those people who try and make it look like nobody lives in their house. Do you know what I mean by this?
What?
Right.
Maybe?
So the people who are hell-bent on making their house seem like an absolute show home that nobody has ever lived in.
Okay.
There is no stuff of note or character in it. They...
Mm.
Like, it's, you know, straight out of like a made catalog with just absolute zero feeling. It's a house, not a home, right?
Mm.
And I'm just like, why are you going to so much effort to make your home feel cold and lifeless? I'm fine with tidy houses. I like things in the right places. But there's a limit to when it becomes just like too much. And
yeah.
This is your home. This is where you live. Literally, you live in this house. Why are you trying to make it seem as if nobody has ever lived in this house ever?
Mm.
And the thing that does it for me is when people start to hide their like appliances. God forbid they have a kettle on the countertop or a toaster, and you
or
see
like an adapter plugged into a plug socket. Yeah,
but not even that. You see all these like new kitchen remodels that everybody loves and shares on social media, being like, oh my God, absolute goals. And it's little tiny compartments or hidden like fake wall sections that you press and then all of a sudden it kind of comes up and all of your appliances are there.
Yeah, like and then the sink is like you press a button and it like sinks into the counter and you're just like, that's fucking annoying, just give me a sink.
Or you have like a cover that you put over your sink that makes it look like one big countertop and you're like,
God.
It's a kitchen, you need a fucking sink. Why are you so perturbed about having a sink? Or not even that, why are you so perturbed about people knowing you have a sink?
Why are you ashamed of your sink? Yeah.
And then, tidy house, great.
This is a great pick. This is annoying me.
Like, a tidy house is great. A tidy house is fine. I know people who have horrifically messy houses, who have no organization, it's just an absolute fucking bomb site.
Sure.
And I hate that. But I hate this more. Because at least that house has a bit of character. Oh, no. Your house is fine. Your house is fine. I know people who are like borderline hoarders, but don't know. Yeah, so for me, I want my house and my home to have a visible influence of me.
Mm.
Or the people living in it. Yes, yeah. In it. And yeah, that means that we live in this house. We have, I don't know, a blanket on the sofa because it's -5 degrees today.
Yeah.
And that doesn't need to go in a little ottoman storage or under the sofa that nobody can ever see.
Yeah.
Or, you know what? Yeah. We we make toasties a lot. So there's a toasty maker on the cabinet. And sick. It's like, or a pot, you know, like a, sometimes we leave our La Creuset pot on the hob. Just like, it's clean, but we're just like, yeah, it's fine now. And we'll use it. And it also, it's a nice looking pot and it fits with the color scheme of the room. That's fine. But people live here. This is fine. Yeah. What is this obsession with just making it seem as if your house or your home, every room is in a catalog? Or you're like, you know, it feels like you're trying to sell your house, right? You know, when you sell your house, you essentially need to strip all of your like emotion and kind of character, like personal character, out of it and make it seem as bare as like as bare as possible, but with all of the amenities and like
So people can imagine their own lives in it.
It feels like that, and it just feels totally soulless. And I just don't understand, one, why you'd want to live in that, and two, why you would go to the immense amount of effort to maintain that.
And also, I'd say as a guest in those houses, I'm super uncomfortable because I'm like, I'm aware that there is an aesthetic being maintained here at all times, and like
there's an expectation.
Yeah,
that and you like, need my, to adhere my, to.
My in-laws have like just a super tidy house, but I always get pissed off when I'm there because I think that I don't mind that, like I would like our house to be tidier, to be honest, but like. I think that you start wanting your house tidy, and if you're not careful, you get into other habits. So you start off by saying, oh, I want our house tidy. And then you buy, you know, a nice table or something. And then you're like, well, I don't want people just putting a coffee mug on that table. So we need to get coasters. And then you start having coasters. And then you're like, well, when the coasters aren't being used, they need to be stacked like in the holder. And suddenly you're kind of like three layers deep. And if anyone puts a mug down without a coaster, it causes you distress. And I think I would much rather be the house where people just put their coffee mug down on the table and don't worry that I'm going to be like, could you actually use it? I'm really anti-coaster, to be honest with you.
I'm very pro-coaster.
No, but I just think I make them the cup of tea or coffee when they're in my house. I know there's not tea or coffee slopping down the sides of it,
but there could be condensation, and it depends.
I don't care that much.
Is the surface is on porous or non-porous? Because that's
I just don't care. Yeah, but okay, there's one table. With most of the stuff in the house, I'm just like, if it's a table, it's here to serve a purpose. Our media unit is here for a TV to go on it. Like, it's here to have things put on it.
It's
the same way that, you know, when people are kind of like really precious about keeping their shoes super clean, you know, they have their like box fresh white shoes and insist that, and look, it's sometimes you want them to stay fresher a little bit longer, but if you get too uptight about it, you'll just never enjoy anything.
I'm fine with enjoying, say, the hypothetical table. I'm fine with enjoying it, but if I'm the one who fucks it up, I can make my peace with that because, you know, we paid for it. But if somebody else fucks it up, I'm going to look at that imperfection and think of that person every time and be like, dick.
It depends how it happened.
Yeah.
When people are really clumsy, it annoys me. Or when somebody treats my house in a way that I know they wouldn't treat their own, that fucking pisses me off.
This reminds me of like during the pandemic when all the hairdressers were closed and people were cutting their own hair and that.
Yeah. That was a dark time.
I chose to cut my own hair personally over asking Jess to do it because I knew that if I fucked it up, I could make my peace with it. Whereas if Jess fucked it up, I would be annoyed at her, but it wouldn't be fair for me to be annoyed at her because I can't expect her to be. So I was like, I'm not going to put you in that position. Because for those who don't know, I'm incredibly anal about my hair.
Yeah. You don't say.
Which is, you know, you don't achieve perfection without putting in the time, right?
I've basically never seen you with fucked up hair.
No, it does. I don't leave the house with it. Actually, interesting, this morning, on the way to, when I was getting ready this morning, do you ever have those days where you go to style your hair and it just doesn't work? I was styling my hair and it just was like the fringe just wasn't working. Oh. So I went into the bathroom and rewashed it and then tried it.
You were like, scorched earth. We have to start this all over again.
Because of the various products I use, it was like, we've come to a point now where it can't be undone. Like, there's nothing I can do to this hairstyle at the minute to undo this and to make it fine or to make it acceptable for me to leave the house. So I'm just going to have to restart. Just
that. I mean, that is
a full factory reset, and then start again.
Damn. See, I've never really got into that because I must say, like, I've never really established with my hair what I want it to be. I just go through periods with it. So I'm never like,
I've established too much.
Well, you're like, I know the style I want to achieve and I know whether I've achieved it. Whereas with me, I'm still kind of like, I normally lose patience, you know, like before I grow it sufficiently long on top to do X or Y style. You know, like it's, I just get too cross about it. But I don't know, maybe if I had higher standards, I would, I'd be the same as you, but here we are. But no, I agree with what you're saying about the show home thing. Like, there's stuff in my house where I'm like, I want it to be tidier. But then I think our bed at night, it's going to have like a hoodie at the end of the bed because sometimes we have to get up in the night to like give the baby some milk, you know.
Or on the like, floor. You know, there's a small pile of clothes on the chair that aren't quite dirty enough to go in the laundry, but aren't clean enough to go back in the wardrobe.
Yeah.
So they just kind of exist in limbo, and that's fine because this is your home and you're living in it and this is your life. And nobody's going to hold that against you because everybody does that.
Yeah.
Whereas the obsession to hide all of that, I just don't understand. It would make me so uncomfortable in my own house.
Yeah. And I just think it just sets an impossible standard. Like, what? Yeah. Okay, agreed. I don't have any more to add on that. I think that's a really solid burn book edition. In a way, I think that this is a similar genre of person. I don't know why. But it's people who are like, who say they don't like sweet things. You can not like sweet things. That's fine. You're allowed to not like sweet things. You know, it's not just people who don't like sweet things, but it's people who make a big point of how they don't have a sweet tooth because I think they're sophisticated. Mm. It's this thing of like, ugh, I'd actually be amazed if I haven't put this in the burn book before, but it pisses me off anew every few months. Like, it feels like the sort of thing I've put in before, but I don't think I have. But you know what I mean? It's that thing of like, oh, I don't actually really like sweet things. If you go for cocktails with someone and they're like, oh, what have you got? And you're like, I don't know, a fucking apple tini or something. And they have like a little sip of it and they go, oh, too sweet. Or there are some people whose response to everything is, oh, that's very sweet. You know, and I just think, we get it. Like, you think you're sophisticated. And I actually think it's the same genre of person who says they don't like football. Because I work in football, I feel like I meet a lot of people who are so excited to tell me that they don't like football. Mm. And I think they think that my reaction is going to be, oh my God, are you the most sophisticated person on earth that you don't like football? There's this weird thing that's happened in our society, genuinely only over the last like 40, 50 years, where people have decided that being clever or being an intellectual and being into dumb things, dumb movies, dumb sports, is like those things are incompatible, which has never been the case in human history. That has never been the case before that point. But, well, except maybe, I guess, for like the Victorians. And I think these people kind of are wannabe Victorians. So yeah, there's this attitude of just like, it's this kind of superiority, as if, oh well, sweet things are for children, sweet things are obviously delicious, and I actually prefer things that are not obviously delicious. It's kind of the same way that, look, I like Negronis, I like Amari, you know, I like a bitter drink, but I think some people make a big show of it because they think that liking a bitter drink is sophisticated, the same way that a lot of people think that they're more sophisticated because they like black coffee, when it's not more sophisticated, it's just a preference. Like, black coffee is sometimes what you want, that's fine, but it's not a fucking personality that you don't like sweet coffee or you say, oh no, I would never have sugar in my coffee. Yeah. Fuck off.
Right, so it's not so much the disliking of sweet things, it's more the connotations that come with it.
It's people who It's people who say, who feel obliged to tell you that they don't like sweet things. It's kind of the same way that I feel like I know a lot of people who talk about how they're always cold, and I feel like they're trying to tell me that they're thin. You know, that's what I hear when someone's like, I'm just always cold. It's like, okay, you're thin. Like that kind of stuff. Like, I just, there's something about it which is like fake sophistication. There's a term, it's a Russian term, or it's a corrupted Russian term that Nabokov used, which is like poshlost. And it's refined vulgarity.
Right.
So it's these people who think that they are acting in this kind of highbrow way, but actually they just betray like what fucking cretins they are. And that's kind of what I think that is. It's this attitude of I'm better than other people, but they're not actually sophisticated enough to be able to tell that the things you like are just the things you like.
Yeah.
And that if you like skiing but not football, that doesn't make you a better person than the people who do like football.
But it's also just it's a perception of affluence, right? Or intelligence in that. I personally prefer to go for a cheese board over what generally is on any dessert menu. But that still doesn't mean that that's just because I like cheese.
Mm.
I also like sticky toffee pudding.
Yeah.
And if somebody said, oh, sorry, sir, we don't have any cheese left, I'd be like, cool. Sticky toffee pudding, please. I wouldn't feel any more or less of myself for having a sticky toffee pudding or another sweet dessert, ice cream, whatever, over a cheese board or a digestive, like a port or something. It wouldn't make me feel any different. I would just choose something that I enjoy, because why wouldn't I?
Yeah, again, you know, it's this thing. It's the same as the steak thing.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking that when you said it.
If you like your steak blue, it's completely fine with me. I have no issue with people ordering their steak blue. I have no issue with people saying, I never really get a pudding at a restaurant because I don't really want it that much. I don't really enjoy it. I'd rather get the cheese. I think often the cheese is the better option. But it's just the thing of this slight tone of like self...
judgment. Yeah.
Of just like self-worship that comes out when people do it. I think that's kind of the through line through most of the things I put in the burn book on here. And I think food especially is this real arena of class, of assertion about class and superiority. It's an area where people are like, oh, well, I would never eat that, or I would never do that, or I would never hold a knife that way, or blah, blah, blah. And all of that stuff is saying there are two kinds of people, the right kind of people, the wrong kind of people, and I'm the right kind of person. I remember having this conversation with my dad once, where my dad knows like nothing about films. I swear my dad's seen about 5 films in his life. And I was talking about, I don't know, I was talking about the films I really liked. I was working in the film at the time. And I mentioned Jaws, and my dad was like, Jaws? You know, and he was kind of like, his perception was, isn't that like a dumb movie about a shark? And I was like, well, firstly, it's not a dumb movie about a shark. I think a really sophisticated movie about a shark. But yeah, it kind of is a dumb movie about a shark. Like, that's fucking fine. That's what it's meant to be. Let's not pretend as well that like Shakespeare didn't write jokes about erections, because he fucking did. Like, that he wasn't simultaneously playing to the aristos and to like the peasants. Like, that is the way that art has always worked. But now I think there are people who want to say, well, we're the kind who go to the theatre and the chavs go to the fucking football. And I think, well, that makes me want to go to the football, because I can't be dealing with this smug complacency, this belief in like your own essential superiority. I just find it contemptible. It makes me angry as fuck. It's the same way that when I was at uni and I'd come across real posh dickheads, my Kent accent would start to come out really hard, because I was just annoyed, and because
you just wanted to distance yourself from that.
Yeah, and I just objected to them, and I was just like, I don't want to be associated with these people. But anyway, that's enough. What are you taking out of the burn book this week? What have you not hated?
So the thing I haven't hated this week, and I will continue to not hate for the next couple of weeks, is the Christmas wine down.
Mm.
Are you familiar? Because it is a beautiful, beautiful time of year. I know I've bashed Christmas before on previous pods, but this is a genuine top tier characteristic of Christmas. When you get to about anywhere between 2.5 weeks and 10 days before Christmas, like Christmas Day. So you're coming into the second week of December onwards, where people just start slowly but surely give less of a fuck about what they're doing, particularly with work, but also just generally. And everybody is just looking at that kind of break in between Christmas and New Year, just looking to do the least amount of work that is acceptable to get to that moment when they then just get the down tools and just forget about it all until January. If you're lucky enough to have that period off, I've got, I think, just under 2 weeks off between Christmas and New Year, or across that time. And it's just, it's the only time of the year where everybody does it in unison, because you kind of do it when you go on summer holiday a week before you're going away for 10 days.
Yeah.
You also kind of start to wind down and tie up your loose ends and just ease into your holiday as much as you can, as much as it is as acceptable. But everybody else around you is still in normal work mode because they don't have a summer holiday that week.
Sure.
So it's more difficult to do it without it being as visible. Whereas with Christmas, everybody's in the same boat. So shit just slowly but surely just starts to slow down. People give less of a fuck. Your deadlines get pushed back a little bit. Being like, oh, you're meant to deliver this today. Being like, ah, oh, yeah. I'll get onto that in a bit. And people don't care. They're like, oh, it's Christmas. It's nearly Christmas. We just need to get over this line. And in similar fashion, my second part of this, which is tied, is the fuck it, it's Christmas mentality. Whenever I want to do anything now, drink on a Tuesday, fuck it, it's Christmas. Right? Anything I want to do within the next 3 weeks, I can justify by saying, fuck it, it's Christmas.
Yeah.
And that is just pure hedonism. Love it.
Yeah, like the other day, I was just like, the baby had woken up early and I had to like nip to the shops. And I saw like a lint bear in there, and I was like, fuck it. It's Christmas. Like, I'll have that bear. Took it home. Gave Coco the little, you know, the little jangly bell they have around their necks. She loves it. And I ate a little chocolate bear. Not the big one. Not the small one either, the medium one. but exactly. Yeah. I love this time of year because it feels like everybody is simultaneously in a festive mood. Whether they're into Christmas or not, it does feel like like the last couple of days before summer holiday at school,
when
school. Nothing is happening.
Yeah.
No one tries to teach you anything.
I don't feel so much that people are festive. I feel it's more it's a time of year where people just let their inhibitions go. You know, in the other 49 weeks of the year or whatever, everyone's like, can't do this because of this. Or they restrict what they want to do based on the lifestyle they feel that they should be leading.
Yeah.
In terms of health, in terms of whatever, career, so forth. But this 3 week period, 3 to 4 week period, that just goes out the window and people just do what they want.
Yeah.
And it's great.
It is great.
And they do so without shame, because I feel society's kind of built in a way that outside of this window of fuck it, it's Christmas, when you do the thing you want to do that you probably know you maybe shouldn't, you do it and it's good. But then afterwards you reflect on that being like, you know, I went to the pub and had 4 pints instead of going to the gym.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily feel bad about myself. I don't feel great about it.
Yeah.
On like after the dust has settled and you're like,
yeah, it feels like more of a reflection on your long-term habits.
Yeah.
Whereas at Christmas, you're like, well, obviously I won't behave this way in January.
Yeah.
That would be crazy.
That would be crazy. Yeah. So yeah, I just love the guilt-free hedonism of this little small, beautiful window of the year.
And especially, I think, in this relatively uptight country.
Well, yeah. We're kind of nice at this uptight time country.
Yeah, and it's nice. That yesterday was the 9th anniversary of my first date with Emma.
Oh, wow.
And so we had our first date right around Christmas. We had our first 3 dates just before Christmas, and our 4th date, she came to stay at my friends in Brighton over New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And I think it did just kind of contribute to the magic of the whole thing, that it was during this period where everyone was kind of day drinking. You know, we were getting smashed at like 4 o'clock. And we weren't the only ones. We were surrounded by people doing that. Yeah. And that felt great.
I think at Christmas, you rarely think about the ramifications of your actions.
Yeah.
You live in the moment. As ridiculous as it sounds, you live in the moment and you don't think about what your choices that evening necessarily. You don't think about your choices that evening will do in the coming days.
Yeah.
I've woken up on Christmas Day with a fucking club stamp on my wrist.
Oh my God. I woke up on Christmas Day.
I was much younger, but yeah, like on Christmas Day, I was like, that was a terrible idea. I'm struggling.
That is genuinely nuts.
Lunch.
I mean, I've woken up on Christmas Day before and been like,
but
I don't have my
it.
Coat because I left it in a bar last night. And then I vomited a lot that morning. That was during a particularly bad period in my early 20s. But like, yeah, interestingly, it's that thing, isn't it? Of like, everyone's a child at Christmas. Well, you are a child in the sense of being an adult is about thinking about the ramifications of your actions, and being a child is specifically not having to care about consequences. So maybe, yeah, this time of year where your consequences aren't a factor, you're suddenly like, the magic of Christmas is genuinely not caring about what this says about me or whatever.
Because comparative to being a child, being an adult is shit.
Yeah, it is. Well,
it is. For a lot of things.
In some ways. In terms of responsibility and stuff.
In terms
yes.
of responsibility and pressure, etc.
Sure. But being a child is also shit.
Living is shit.
Yeah, it's just not good. It's just not
is
good.
Is that what we're getting at? So
I think, well, I mean, is that not the premise of the show?
Well, yeah, lovely. I mean, it's the premise of my entire mentality and my entire persona is built
exactly.
on that.
Exactly.
Exactly. What. Trying to turn it back to some positivity here. What did you not hear this week?
Mine's a quick one. It's just a movie. So there's a movie called Mad God, which came out last year. Very limited release, but you can now buy it online. I think you can buy it on Amazon. And I've been waiting to see this for a long time because it's made by a guy called Phil Tippett. And Phil Tippett, you might actually recognize, if you've ever seen that meme where it's a screenshot of the credits from Jurassic Park, where it says dinosaur supervisor Phil Tippett, and people are like, what were you doing, Phil? People died. the dinosaurs killed people, Phil. But Phil Tippett is one of the most important people in the history of visual effects. Phil Tippett worked on the original Star Wars trilogy. He worked on RoboCop. He worked on Jurassic Park. He worked on Starship Troopers. He's won 2 Oscars. He's truly one of the guys who created visual effects in film.
But was that also when like Star Wars was also like actual?
Yeah,
like, figurine
physical.
Graphics. Yeah, yeah, it was physical.
Yeah, yeah, like the first Star Wars movies when they've got you know like the little speeders that are like zooming across the ground. The way that they were on wheels.
Yeah.
And the way that they made them look like they weren't on wheels is they drew a line of Vaseline on the camera lens, specifically at the level where the wheels were, so it just looks like a blur. Like, but you know, all the costumes, all the animatronics and things, you know, like this was Phil Tippett stuff, and he's just kind of an amazing figure in film history. But anyway, one of his real passions was stop motion animation, and in 1990-ish, when he was working on RoboCop 2, he started working on this film called Mad God. A full-length stop-motion film, which is obviously an absolute bitch to put together. And he finally finished it and put it out in 2020. So it took 30 years to make this thing. And it was completed with help from a Kickstarter, and it was a really long, arduous process to get there. And it's genuinely a pretty disgusting film. So it's a stop motion animation. You basically follow this character who gets in this lift and seems to basically descend into hell. And on the way, there are like there are monsters and weird machinery. It's all really kind of surreal. It's completely dialogueless. There's no dialogue in the whole thing. It's all just imagery. And it's kind of like a nightmare. But it's such an incredible testament to the staying power of one guy. It is the most labor-intensive way to make a film possible. Stop-motion animation is such a nightmare. Stop-motion animation, when it's done now, is so much easier than it used to be because people will swap out heads, you know, to have different facial expressions and there are animatronic elements normally, all that kind of stuff. Well, this was done pretty much the old-fashioned way. And it's just really inventive. It's really funny. And I'd been really excited to see it and to see the culmination of the ambitions of, I think, one of the most significant figures in the last kind of 50 years of Hollywood filmmaking made me really happy. It's definitely not for everyone. People might go away and hate it, but it's like £2-3 on Amazon. It's, I think it's like 83 minutes long. It's not going to cost you much to watch it. And
that's
just for the,
so long for a stop motion movie.
For a stop motion, yeah. But
that's crazy.
But it's short for a movie, right? So, but the imagery is truly remarkable. And it is just relentlessly weird. So I really recommend Mad God. Go and check it out. That's the thing I'm taking out of the burn book this week.
I'm looking at some pictures of it right now. And it's very interesting.
It's fucking gross. It's really gross. But I was just watching it like, I cannot believe that he made this. I can't believe he saw this through.
I'm looking at the movie poster for it now.
Yeah.
And on it, there is one quote from Guillermo del Toro that just says, Phil Tippett is a master.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that from Guillermo del Toro, that's pretty high praise from somebody who's very, very well respected in the industry.
And somebody as well who has married high quality filmmaking with a long-standing interest in visual effects. You know, Guillermo del Toro, all his films, the visual effects have such a consistent style. You know, whether it's his Hellboy movies, whether it's Pan's Labyrinth, you can tell, or The Shape of Water, you can tell a Guillermo del Toro design. And so he is somebody who's super influenced by Phil Tippett.
Apparently his new Pinocchio was very, very good.
I haven't watched it yet. Yeah, I haven't watched it.
Very, very high praise from a very talented filmmaker.
Yeah. So anyway, go check that out and buy it if you can, because, well, I think you have to, unless you've got like maybe a Shudder subscription or something. But just to support a guy who, without whom we would not have some of the real masterpieces of modern filmmaking, and whose legacy continues to be felt in filmmaking today. So, should we bring it to an end there and head over onto the subscription side? Thanks very much for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, then drop us a review on Apple or whichever podcast app you use. I don't know. I presume you could do it anywhere. As well, if you want access to our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/patrickvs. You can either sign up at the $2 level just to support us, which we really appreciate because obviously it is quite a bit of work making the podcast, but if you subscribe at the $6 level, you'll get access to our bonus episodes. There are two of those every month and they are normally long. So thanks for listening and we'll see you next time. Bye.